Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
All right, Jason and Taryn, well, I've really enjoyed hearing your story, and I can tell you guys have put a lot of thought and a lot of heart into your decisions. And now I'm going to, you know, kind of do what I often do and just kind of – I've been storing up a bunch of questions, and I'm going to just kind of offer them in serial nature. Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's serial with an S, not serial with a C.
I would really love some frosted plates at this point, actually. It's been kind of a long talk.
Okay. That might not go well with the microphone, actually.
Oh, well. Okay, I'll eat them after.
All right. Ooh, I could find some Rice Krispie treats. I mean, some Rice Krispies, right?
Great. Okay.
Put them right next to the mic.
That's okay, so all right. So, Jason, one of the things that you said at the end of the interview that was just really striking to me was, and I'm paraphrasing, but you basically said, I think it's time to move beyond true and false. I think it's time. And basically what you were saying is you were disinterested in whether or not the Book of Mormon was a historical document. You were disinterested in even whether there really was a God or not. You know, you were basically saying, I think, that it's all about living a Christ-like life, and the church kind of helped you to do that. And, you know, Taryn, I think you were on a pretty similar page. Mm-hmm. And then something you just said, Jason, was really interesting. You kind of said at one point you thought that the church led people to live Christ-like lives, but that at some point you decided that, you know, wasn't the case any longer. And so my first question, Jason, I'll ask you first, then Taryn, you can add. You know, you could say that there's lots of problems with the church, but has the church become less good at promoting Christ-like behavior? Like, has that changed? Or has your calculus on the good that the church does do changed? Does that make sense?
It does completely. I don't think, I mean, if you listen to my sort of historical litany from a little back, I don't think ultimately there's been much change. I think the church has a long history of dubious moral choices on big issues. I think the church produces a lot of people who are really good in the small details of their lives, but who commit themselves to a cause that in the big picture doesn't always make the right choices. And one of the things that's been really important to me is realizing that small picture goodness comes from a lot of places. There are a lot of ways to learn to be kind and loving and attentive and sacrificing, and to do that in your life and towards other people that don't also lead you to end up on the wrong side of the civil rights movements over and over again. To make these mistakes that impose costs on all kinds of people. I think when we talked before, these costs were just as real. And one of the things that was different was that I wasn't as sensitized. I wasn't as aware. I mean, I'm going to use this word of privilege. I was privileged. I was able to not recognize what the church was doing to our gay and lesbian and queer brothers and sisters. I wasn't seeing it. I had friends who'd gone through it. I had friends who'd been marginalized and devastated in adolescence because of these issues, and I'd been always very sympathetic on that. But I had been able to close my eyes to the direct hand of the church in it until the church tried to divorce my friends. And that was a lesson to me. That was a lesson that this was personal and real. This was not abstract. This was not something that can be traded off against other goods. This is something that is wrong. That is wrong. That's my moral conviction, that it's wrong to hurt others because of your views. It's wrong to have those views, I think. But it's more wrong to be so sure of your views that you're going to hurt others who aren't hurting you first. And I think that that's something the church has been doing for so long. But I was willing to overlook it because of the kind and loving and wonderful people I've known in the church. And now coming to realize that people like that are all over the place, that people find those values by reading Plato and Aristotle, or by meditating in the Buddhist tradition, or by doing UU meetings, or just because it's in their nature, that the world outside of Mormonism is as full of those virtues as the world inside, but not always the vices. I don't think this is a change in the church. I think this is a change in me. I've been taught. I've been more educated and more aware.
And I'll just push you a tiny bit, because I think if I had gone back 9 years, you listed the LGBT issue as your number one, is the first issue you listed.
Absolutely.
So I think back, if I had gone back time warp 9 years ago and said, is the church harming LGBT people? I think you would have said yes.
Yes.
And I think if I would have even said, are there good people outside of Mormonism? You would have said absolutely.
Yes. But I felt at the time that Mormonism had a better vision for how to live your life. I did. I felt that it had a better vision. And there's a little bit to unpack here, I think. I felt, first of all, that the LGBT stuff was so important, and it's just devastatingly important. But I was willing to trade it off against other things. And that was a mistake. I needed to grow up. I didn't know yet that there are things you can't trade off, and this is one of them. But also, I saw the other side of the balance as being weightier than it is. I saw the Mormon church as, first of all, teaching people in the normal structure of their lives to be better people than outside. And I'm not sure that's true. But also, I saw that the egalitarian and hopeful and wonderful and inclusive passages in the Book of Mormon, mm-hmm. the stories of the society without class divisions and creeds and ethnicities and hierarchy. And I thought that was Mormonism. I thought that was an essential part of the Mormon ethic. And the fact is, I think that's a dead part of the Mormon ethic. And that's another problem, is that one of the things I saw as a seed of hope, I think it's not a seed in this tradition anymore. I think that's been rejected. And that puts me in a position of trading off something that can't be traded off. There's the incommensurability. How many dead people, how many suicides of LGBT people can I trade off against the vision of someday having Zion? But then the reality that most Mormons don't believe in the Zion I read in those scriptures. They believe in a Zion that's a free market, where the rich people are rich because they work hard. And that isn't the Zion that 4th Nephi describes. But it's the Zion that Mormons seem to think. And that there's a loss in terms of the positive vision I saw there too.
Yeah, and we talked a bit about that in my interview with Rock Waterman, that if you really read the Book of Mormon and take it seriously, some people say it really condemns the current church.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to that. And, yeah. We spent a lot of time writing about this when we were internet activists. Our whole Latter-day Saint Liberation Front blog was centrally about this theme, about the sort of the egalitarian vision in Mormonism. Not just the Book of Mormon, also the Doctrine and Covenants. It really is a strong theme. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. The scriptures in Mormonism have all kinds of themes that aren't active in the church anymore. And, some of them, we're happy that they're not, right? We're mm-hmm. happy that polygamy is not active.
Yeah, but, or, completely subjective, no matter, whatever you're feeling is the moral thing to do, cut that guy's head off.
Yeah, exactly. we're not asked to do what Nephi did. And we're happy that that's not part of our life. But if we recognize that those things are not really part of lived Mormonism, we also need to accept that the loss of the egalitarian, communitarian ethos is also real.
Right. Taryn, did you have anything to add to that specific question?
The question, what was the original question?
Now? Is anything to add about is the church sort of, less encouraging of Christ-like living than you thought before, or is the church, you know, become less encouraging of Christ-like living since our last interview?
Honestly, you know, I don't think it's changed. I don't think my perception of it has changed either. Right. I mean, I always thought it was a very human church full of very human flaws, not just on the individual level, but the institutional one. And, you know, I suffered from some of the same privilege that Jay suffered from, but not nearly as much because, you know, I was a woman. And I'd grown up in a very different social position in Mormon culture. And I was always weird. So, you know, people dealt with me in a different way. And so, I think I actually had a relatively clear-eyed picture of what the church was, or, you know, I don't think my understanding of that has changed. I never thought that it was the great tool for Christian maturation that I think maybe it seemed like to Jay, but that was because I had been on the, you know, frankly, the receiving end of so much nastiness during my Mormon, my Jack Mormon childhood.
Right.
And, you know, and the thing is, it wasn't like I thought Mormons were worse than other people. And I don't think that now. But I do think that the institutional culture is inflexible to the point that, that it's really, really hard for people within the church to somehow address all of the problems in church culture and in Mormon culture by being more Christ-like. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then there's the question of how Christ-like is it good to be? You know, and I still love that. You know, I find myself, when I'm walking alone, I always find myself singing A Poor Wayfaring Man of Grief. And I love that just as much as I ever did for all the same reasons. But, and I even get that vagus nerve activation at the end, but I no longer am so sure that the Christian morality that I believed was, you know, that I still think is the thing to do and that I believed was infallibly the thing to do is necessarily, I don't feel so sure of myself anymore. So, you know, about the whole, did Jesus have it exactly right thing? I mean, I think generally, yeah, love your neighbor as yourself. That's a great piece of advice. And I think we should all do it, but, I've come to realize that the problem with being Christ-like, with a whole bunch of people being Christ-like, is that while at the individual level, maybe it's a moral thing to, you know, to turn the other cheek and to give and give and give, you know, and do what the little stream said, I do think that's the thing to do. In the aggregate, what it leads to are a bunch of people who let themselves be cogs in a machine that is maybe vanity, vanity, you know, like yeah. Ecclesiastes, and maybe actually bad.
You know, that's the thing. I mean, one way to look at Mormonism over the last 20 years is that this is an organization that's taken millions of devoted, loving, pro-family people and turn them into a big collective home wrecker, right? Mm-hmm. None of them wants to go out and break up families. We had a set of friends who were married and committed to their marriage. And about 6 months after the proposition that seemed like it was going to break their marriage legally, they ended up having so much stress that they split. Do I know that the proposition caused them to split? No. Do I think it did? Yes. Does that mean that Mormonism as a collective broke their home? Maybe it does. Would they be the only ones? No. Mormonism is out there destroying families. Now, it saves families.
Which is not what it's trying to do.
Families. So. No Mormon wants to break up homes. None of them. No individual out there. But collectively, this process is doing that. Mm-hmm. The morality we have to look at isn't the individuals. It's what we as a group do when we are a group. Because that's the morality of being in the group.
Yeah, it was like paying tithing. I mean, you wanted to pay tithing to help pay for the expenses of the church, and with any luck to help people who were in much more need than you. But at the same time, there was always the nagging question. They keep saying, oh, we're not using tithing funds for these political actions, but that's ignoring the basic fungibility of money. You know, yeah. If I give the church my money, they have more money to do this with. And how do I explain that to the kid I taught in Sunday school, who I'm pretty sure is gay and is angry at the church and clearly ready to come out and is going to just, you know, burn all these relationships because he feels hated, you know, justifiably feels hated. How do I explain to him that during the time I was doing everything I could to signal that I thought that he was okay and he didn't need to believe this nasty stuff about himself, I was giving mm-hmm. money to the organization that was trying to make sure he'd never be able to have a long-term, you know, committed relationship. You know, I mean, how do I explain that to that boy? If I, you know, this is a real thing. It actually happened. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, we're not doing hypotheticals tonight. We're yeah. not naming right. names, but these are real,
you know,
and that's the thing. I mean, I think a big part of the shift for me is moving from first of all, this dream for a better egalitarian future that I don't think many Mormons support, to a realization of what Mormons actually want. And second of all, a recognition that the morality of the group as a group is what I need to pay attention to, mm-hmm. right? That yeah, if I want to stay to be a better person myself, but in doing that, I make the group a little bit worse, that's a kind of selfish choice.
Yeah. And it's a hard thing to realize.
What do you mean by making the group worse?
If I enable the group to carry out these bad actions a little bit more by being there, right? If I give money that you know, frees up an extra $10,000 for political action to hurt people, if I by being there persuade someone else who's liberal and doubting along these lines that, hey, there is a solution because look at that guy, then
and this
I'm,
is something that's actually happened to me. I had someone get mad at me at the public library because when she found out that I had decided I didn't believe, because she had been looking at Jay and I specifically, apparently, and saying, well, if these guys are in it, it can't be that crazy.
And see, that's the thing. If people are doing that, then I have to carry the weight of what mm-hmm. the church can do as a collective because of us and the people we've influenced.
Yeah.
And what the church doesn't do is listen to me. It doesn't listen to me.
No.
What the church does is take the resources that I make available and do what it wants as a group, as an organization. And what it does as an organization, I don't support.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to accept.
No, I talked to Brad about this, and his response was, every organization does harm.
No.
No.
No, they don't.
We thought that too.
I mean, look at the Quakers. What have the Quakers done? The Quakers opposed slavery. The Quakers died for the civil rights movement. Find one-tenth of the harm that Mormonism has done that Quakers as a group have done. You can't. So
if you bring this up in, you know, if you use this example, someone always brings up Richard Nixon.
Yeah, but Richard Nixon wasn't the Quakers. He was
no,
a Quaker,
kind of.
And he was a kind of fallen Quaker. But the point is, the Quaker church as a church took political stands and got them right. That's possible. The Unitarians have done a good job too. I mean, there are organizations out there that just do a better job. No, nobody's perfect, but that's not the standard.
You know, we're going to a UU congregation now, and it's the one that spearheaded the desegregation of the city we live, not of Chicago, but of the suburb
of Evanston,
we live
in
the late 70s, when it was still legal in Evanston for people to sell their houses with clauses in the contracts saying that the next owner could not sell to black people. and trying to make that, you know, and this clause has to be in any sale contract that you make too, da 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 da.
So we left a church whose official hospital used to segregate blood on racial lines.
And now we're
attending a church that stuck its neck out to end segregation.
Like, seriously, caused the members in the congregation some real problems, really risked a lot. People were very, very angry at them, and they did it anyway. You know, I mean, they were the ones who lobbied to make this illegal.
And that's my Mormonism. I'm in favor of people who take risks for what's right, even if the risks are local and small and didn't show up in the newspaper. You know, that's what I want. That's what I want to be. I want to be that. I want to be the group with that.
And you don't assume it's always going
to
work.
That I trust the neighbors, not to be perfect, but to be good. Right? Mm-hmm. Not the neighbors, but the everyone, the collective. Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to be part of a community where if I get called, well, I don't get called to do anything, right? I say, this is something I can help with, right? You know, which actually means that I end up doing things that I'm useful with, right? But if I decide to go work in the kids program, I don't have to argue with the people running the program about whether or not they need to take required legal precautions to prevent child abuse, you know, because no one's going to say,
our church does.
Yeah.
We had experience in California. In California, the law is in children's classes in church, you have to have two adults, and the church didn't do it.
Like they actually tried to, you know, they tried to convince the local wards not to do it, despite the fact that it was breaking the law.
They do that now, though, right?
I don't know.
I hope so. I mean, I think now,
unless it's a female teacher, if a male's involved, it's going
to be. It doesn't matter. I mean, in California, if it's a woman, it still has to be two adults. Yeah. I mean, do you think women don't abuse children?
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing about it is that I want to be part of the community that doesn't say, well, but none of us would do that.
Yeah.
Not because they suspect each other, but because they realize that being a part of the community doesn't make them automatically righteous or perfect or anything else.
Yeah.
That's something
they understand. They understand that good organizations are the organizations that make people better because of how the organization works.
Mm-hmm.
Organizations that aggregate good impulses up into good actions. That's what we're looking for. And those things exist. Not perfect.
No, perfect, never perfect.
You're going to have to let go of. But good. That you can find that.
Right.
What is that? What is that saying? Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very good. Next question. Taryn, and we don't have to dig too much into this, but you know, you talked about how part of your logic stream, and this is just a small thing, you talked about how part of your logic stream was that it didn't seem fair or right that God would make your brain such that you had a hard time, you know, knowing that he existed or receiving his communications.
Mm-hmm.
And the immediate thought that jumped to mind is, and we talked about theodicy later, well, you know, I could see an insensitive believing Mormon just saying, hey, get in line. There's theodicy all over the place. That just happens to be yours. But it doesn't, you know, it's not, you know, pain and suffering is not unique to Taryn.
But I mean, it makes you think, so what's going on here?
Yep.
You know, I mean, it's not that I value my own suffering above the suffering of others. I certainly don't. And I know why you're asking this. I know this is a question people come up with. The problem is that, I mean, part of this is that one of the things I've learned to do is to stop valuing my own experience less than that of other people, which, you know, is something that I think, I hate to generalize, but I think a lot of Mormons do that. They say, well, you know, I am suffering or I have suffered, but what about everyone else? You know, I shouldn't think about the logical implications or the moral implications for what I'm experiencing, you know, in terms larger than myself, because everybody suffers. It's true that everybody suffers, but here's the thing. That doesn't mean that my suffering is not an example that illustrates, you know, a serious flaw in the logic of belief. You know what I mean? It's just that other people who are suffering more, those examples are more pointed. So it's like you have to actually start, you know, applying. And it's not like I think logic and rationality are perfect, or even that I'm very good at them, frankly. But, you know, you have to. I was always taught that the point of coming to Earth, right, and, you know, the being born and living this life was essentially to learn moral judgment, you know. And then one day I realized that the people who were teaching me that didn't actually want me to exercise it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing. You have to. At some point you have to look around and you have to say, what does what I'm experiencing say about the universe? Does it say anything? If it does, what is it? And what does that mean for what does that mean for how I should act to be a moral person? Mm-hmm. You know?
So for you, the theodicy thing wasn't like the nail in the coffin. It was more the beginning of an exploration.
Well, no, I mean, here's the thing. No, the theodicy thing had always bothered me, of course. I mean, it bothers everyone, right? It's just that some people resolve it and some people don't. But the thing is, it wasn't my own suffering that I was thinking about when I started to think about this. It was, you know, like serious, you know, starvation of children and all the people who've died horribly and, you know, those girls who were kidnapped by Boko Haram this morning, you know, that's the kind of thing that I was thinking about. And before, I had always taken comfort in the existence of God. You know, these horrible things exist, but so does this loving perfection. But then one day I thought, you know, wait, mm-hmm. wait, you know, after my, you know, after the intensity of my ecstatic experience was gone, you know, after it wasn't crowding everything else out, I looked around and I said, but wait, no, this just doesn't make any sense, because this loving, perfect, you know, all everything God, even the loving, perfect, less than everything God that, you know, that I was taught to believe in as a Mormon, that just doesn't make sense with the horrible things in the world. It really, truly doesn't. Not my horrible things. I mean, I can justify those because just like everyone else, I am good at self-punishment. But, you know, not everyone else's. It just didn't make sense.
Yeah. You know, I think also people sometimes let the problem of evil off a little too easy. You know, Mormons mm-hmm. love to do the Alma and Amulek story, right? The village where they're going to burn all of the people to death for believing. And Alma, you know, Amulek wants to stop it miraculously. And Alma says, no.
No, let it happen.
These people need to do it so that they can be righteously punished. And let's set aside the question of why it would be good for those people to be able to be punished. And instead assume that that makes sense. What we now need to justify is why God had to let them die in order to do that. Couldn't there have been a point of no return? You know, maybe when they light the fire, it's over and there's nothing they can do and you can miraculously intervene now. Or maybe you have to get to the point where the people are almost dead, and then you can miraculously intervene. Or why not? They're dead, and you bring them back to life like Lazarus, right? Jesus brings Lazarus back to life just because he loves his sister, right? Why not a bunch of innocent people who were martyred? If God's only point in letting them suffer was to punish these people, and a powerful God has a lot of options other than letting them go all the way through the horrible experience of being burned to death just to make a point. I mean, you actually have to consider that a powerful God has way more options than we usually give him. And when you do that, the problem of evil gets really hard.
You know, and people always talk about the common response I heard to this when I was in the church was, well, some variation of the eternal perspective. Yes, mm-hmm. that was horrible suffering, but in the eternal scheme of things, it was the blink of an eye. And the problem is that, you know, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. First, we don't actually have any evidence that in the eternal scheme of things, it's a tiny proportion of these people's existence. But second, even if it is, you know, we're here and this is now. And,
yeah.
you know, I mean, it's like, it's so easy when you're thinking about heaven and, you know, the glorious eternity that awaits in the resurrection to write off the suffering of other people in the moment.
I mean, a way of thinking about this is if God sent us here to be tested, part of the test was to live in a place where it looks like we die and that's the end. And if our morality doesn't work here, then there's something wrong, because that's where we are and that's where he sent us.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent response. Jason, what would you say to the criticism that you guys are just picking it all apart, that you had these wonderful experiences and now you're just dissecting it and reinterpreting it? And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I met with my stake president for over a year. Mm-hmm. And one of the metaphors he used with me is you've got this beautiful rose, you look at it and it's gorgeous. And what you're doing is you're taking off the petals, you're plucking off the petals, you're inspecting them, and by the time you're done, you've got no rose left.
And, but if it's a real rose, you have a beautiful smell. You have evidence of the rose.
That's true.
Well, I'm just saying, and I'll ask it in a different way because I don't mean to throw you a softball.
Sorry about the overstretched analogy.
No, it's okay. Is there ever a part of you psychologically, kind of the traditional Mormon self, that sort of launches that fear or idea in your mind that maybe that was all real and you've denied it, you know?
No. Look, honestly, no. I mean, first of all, the traditional Mormon part of me says, you know, what do Mormons do? They ask questions and they don't stop until they get the answer. Our Mormon birthright is to know the truth. And I am not going to let that go. I, you know, I'm standing with Joseph in that grove. Maybe we see a different vision. Maybe mine is just the dirt. But I am not going to stop asking. Not because the Pope or the president of the church or Jesus himself tells me. Truth is what we've been promised, and truth is what I'm going to have and nothing less. Truth in the moral sense, truth in the true, in the factual sense, much more the moral sense than the factual sense. I want to know what's right, and I don't want to stop until I know the answer. If picking it apart is what takes to get the answer, then fine. Are we really not supposed to ask questions anymore? Mormons are supposed to ask. That's what our scriptures say. Ask with a sincere heart. That's our story.
Mm-hmm. There's I'm sorry. I had a thought and I can't remember it now.
It's okay. And if it comes back to you, just jump in. So for you, it's very Mormon to ask questions and to seek for truth and to hold truth as an ultimate value.
I mean, of course, it's also Mormon to say, I'm the boss and you're my underling and you should stop questioning me. And then that is also Mormon. I can't deny that at all. That's just a part of Mormonism I don't like. And I'm not going to hold on to that.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Taryn, next question's for you. But Jason, I feel happy to jump in after. And this is, you know, this is a sensitive thing. And I'm going to preface it in the following way. Whenever I ask a hard question, I have to start by directing it at myself. The other day, and Jason, I told you this when we talked. The other day, I was looking up at exmormon.org, and there was a thread about me. And the thread said, basically, does anyone know if John DeLynn has a temple recommend? And the answer was, I'm sure that one of his multiple personalities does.
Oh, that's not nice.
And, you know, in some ways, it's a fair criticism in that I've had this very public journey where I've said, you know, you can believe, and then I'm not so sure I believe, and then no, I changed my mind. You can believe, and then I was like, no, I don't believe at all, and then I'm like, nope, I'm going for belief one more time, and now I'm saying I'm not so sure. And Taryn, what if someone were just to say to you, you're just unstable?
Well, you know? Of course I am. I mean, and this isn't a developmental disorder thing, an autism thing, a depression thing. One thing that I learned when I was, you know, when I was in grad school, I didn't finish my PhD, but, you know, I did a whole bunch of coursework and a bunch of research and things like that. And some of the coursework involved a lot of reading about human consciousness and about the uses of narrative, you know, the way that we use narrative to make our consciousness seem like a one unified thing, right? And the gist of, you know, what the real takeaway from all this research is that we aren't really the same person from one moment to the next. We convince ourselves we are. There's no reason not to, I guess, but everybody is different, you know, one moment to the next moment to the next moment, and certainly over a long period of time. To expect yourself to stay exactly the same, well, it's, you're going to be disappointed. You know, everyone is unstable in this way. The difference is perhaps that, you know, I've been a little more public about it, although not that. I mean, frankly, you know, I did grow up in Utah in kind of the heart of not polygamist fundamentalist, not like in that kind of sense fundamentalist, but, you know, more the academic sense of fundamentalism, fundamentalist Mormonism, right? Literalism, authoritarianism, all that stuff. And I'm not really surprised when I look back that, you know, that my big revelation was that I should go back to a place where I had to to a community where I had a lot of unresolved stuff, you know, with kind of the general difficulty and trauma of having grown up in that situation. I don't think everybody experiences growing up Mormon in Utah as traumatic. Once again, I think that's because I was kind of necessarily an oddball, you know, I mean, I didn't fit. And I was not capable of some of the same kinds of experiences other people had, you know. But I don't think it's surprising that my big revelation back when I was having revelations was that I needed to go back to a community that I had a lot of baggage about, you know. I mean, I realized one day when Jay was in that branch presidency, and I was very pregnant with Artemis. I was sitting in the back of sacrament meeting with my feet up on a chair and two or three college students, like, you know, fawning on my tummy and, you know, and everything else. And people, you know, people looking up at the stand at my husband, that despite everything I thought about myself, I had held onto and somehow internalized this image of competence and adulthood as being Mormon and married in the temple and, you know, and having babies, things like that, which I love babies. I can't have any more, but I love them. So there's, you know, it's all good stuff, all stuff that I love being married to Jay and I love being married. But at some level, I realized that was, I mean, that moment, I realized that I felt like an adult, you know, in a way that when I had been out of the church, I never thought I was going to feel, because there was always this nagging feeling of failure, not spiritual failure, but failure to grow up, failure to be the woman in the pews with a husband and some, you know, middle, you know, semi-important ward calling, trying to pull it all off, you know? So I look back and I think, also, I don't know if you remember or if I talked about it in that original interview, but the thing that sparked my, you know, my deep and really moving experience, you know, of, you know, my deep and moving belief that I needed to go back to the church, was actually a Richard Dutcher movie. It was Brigham City.
Yeah.
That scene at the very end.
Yeah.
Where the bishop tries to refuse the sacrament because he feels like in not figuring out who the serial killer was, he hurt the community.
Right.
And they stand there and force him to take the sacrament. You know, they won't leave until he takes the sacrament because they don't think he's, you know, I still get weepy when I think about it. Here's the thing. Remember that vagus nerve activation thing, that the in-group membership stuff?
Yeah.
That all ties right back into that. I watched that movie. I had that intense experience, exactly the kind that we were talking about, the elevation experience. You know, because it had been my in-group, you know, for most of my life. And that was what moved me to feel like I was supposed to be back in the church, right? So given that I, you know, had a lot of stuff that I needed to resolve, and I clearly didn't feel like I was a grown-up because I wasn't in the church, it's not surprising to me that that was where I had to go, or where I felt like I had to go. But one of the things that the past few years have taught me, and especially my diagnosis and the several years of therapy that I went through to deal with that afterward, I went to therapy every week for 2 years because I was so good at being a semi-functional, non-autistic person that learning how to be a functional autistic person was, it was difficult, you know, the unlearning all of the coping mechanisms that I had learned that just made things harder. It was really hard. I went to therapy for a couple of years, and one of the things I learned, one of the things I figured out is that, gosh, where was I going with this? Jay, do you know where I was going with this? Anyway, any idea?
No, I don't.
Sorry. It's late. I guess what I'm trying to say is just that the diagnosis and the complete restructuring of my identity that came along with it and of my social relationships and everything else, it made me look around and realize that I really, really didn't fit in the life that I was trying to live. You know, I mean, so I had to change. I don't expect that I'll be changing it that drastically again in the future, but maybe I will.
Right.
But who doesn't? People can convince themselves that they're perfectly consistent. But the only way to be perfectly consistent over, you know, 70, 80 years is to very carefully not pay attention to a single thought in your head, you know, and not make any decisions based on your own motivations or impulses. I don't think it's possible, you know?
Right.
People can fool themselves, but
right.
Yeah.
I said, you know, John and Taryn, I just want to quickly say you're both totally flip-floppers, and that's fine.
Yeah.
You just need to accept that. I mean, come on, really. Are you going to find the best life in one go?
Yeah.
I mean, is that really likely that the thing you were born into just happens to be the best life you can have? Or do you need to explore a bit? Why should we feel bad about that?
Because we grew up in a culture that trained us to feel like ever changing our minds about any of this particular stuff was moral failure. That's why.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard for any insular culture not to develop that way. It's not like it's Mormonism's fault.
But, you know. But I want you to tell me why you feel bad about it.
Oh, you're not allowed to ask me questions.
You set it up. You told the story.
Well, did you have a response?
No, I'm good. I think Darren's covered that. I mean, you know,
everybody changes.
Joking. Everybody changes. We're all flip floppers, and if we're not, that means that we're, you know, trusting the really unreliable proposition that we were accidentally born into our best possible life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, that we're basically perfect.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Okay. Next question for you, Jason. So there's three parts to this. It's about it's about influence, right?
Okay.
I know I'm famous for multi-part questions, but how do you feel about the – first of all, did you guys ever get feedback from people who knew that you had done that interview?
Yes.
Did you ever receive feedback from people saying, wow, that interview helped me stay in the church? And if so, how did it feel at the time? That's part one of the question. Mm-hmm. So Jason, you go, then Taryn.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Yeah. No, I mean, I always felt a little – there was a period of a few years, where we had a kind of celebrity among a certain subset of Mormons.
Which was weird.
That interview was part of it. Our blogging was part of it. I always felt a little weird about that. I was not seeking the spotlight or whatever. And that aspect of it was a little strange. But that people had a really positive experience and related to things we said, I felt good about that. I feel good about that.
Okay. So it was strange, but, you know, there's part of you that felt good about that.
Well, I mean, if we said things that help people make sense of what they're going through in their lives, and if there were ideas we had or ways of thinking that helped them make their life better, then I love that.
Okay. All right, Taryn? Mm-hmm. How did you feel at the time?
It was a little overwhelming and weird, not least because my first experience with that was actually a woman who wasn't even Mormon. Mm-hmm. She saw Jay working on LDSLF one day when he thought he was alone in the computer lab at Cal. And she got curious and looked in his browser and found our website. And just, you know, she was kind of a spiritual seeker kind of person. And she loved our website. She ate it up, and she listened to the interview. And the first time I ever met her, she ran up to me and said, "Serenity Valley, it is so nice to meet you. I loved your interview with John Flynn." And I'm like, ah! Of course, it happened again after that with Mormons. And, you know, I don't feel bad about it exactly. I mean, I don't feel like, oh, I have done a horrible disservice to people. I was being honest. You know, I mean, I really believed the things I was saying. And, you know, I mean, it's not amazing that other people would find that kind of a simpatico experience because other people are human too, right? So not too worried about it. I feel a little bit bad because I think I mentioned earlier the experience I had at the public library. It's like, you know, I didn't realize back in the day that there might be somebody whose sole reason for believing that it was not completely off the wall to be Mormon was because I was Mormon, you know, and it wasn't like I was so great. It was just, you know, the basic thing you do, you look around and you say, are there other reasonable people in here? Right. You do that wherever you are. But that I felt kind of bad about because I never lied at church about my beliefs, but I didn't constantly every moment of every Sunday try to correct everybody who interpreted the things that I said pretty much in the same way that I said them in that interview. I didn't try to convince them that their interpretations were biased by their own beliefs, you know, and I felt a little bit bad about that for a while. And then I thought, you know, no, I believed what I was saying. I thought I was, you know, doing the right thing. And that's not an excuse for doing a horrible thing, but I don't think I did a horrible thing. You know, and other people are grown-ups. They need to learn how to evaluate evidence themselves. Okay. You know?
So that was my second part of the question. You don't feel bad now if somebody became committed to the church because of your influence?
Like if they were to become... no, I mean, because that means that my experience makes sense to them. That experience made sense to them, which means that, you know, they may have had some similar experience. And anyway, if they listen to this interview and realize that I have changed my mind, if they're unhappy, maybe that will help them give themselves permission to think about these things. If they still think that they are exactly on the right track, you know, I'm not hurting them. They're not going to listen to me.
And, right. You know, the thing is, I mean, what we said, the experiences we had, all of that was real.
Yeah.
the experiences of people who resonate with what we've said, those are real. Whether they're supernatural or not is irrelevant. I mean, this is, it's real. And if people found happiness in their life because of ideas that came partly from us, or felt more secure in the ideas they were committed to or whatever, I think that's great. If people are using our words as a basis for doing something they think is wrong, then they need to think about what they're doing. For me today to be an active Mormon, an active participant in the LDS Church with the views that I have, I would be doing something that I worry would be wrong. It would be hard for me to ethically justify being active. It doesn't follow that everyone else is in the same position. Obviously, they're not. There are people who just have different points of view, right? They have different information sets than me.
That's one thing.
Yeah.
That phrase you just used, different information sets, this is important. I don't think either of us espouses moral relativism, which, especially since I think it's probably clear at this point in the interview that neither of us actually believes in God anymore, people tend to think that means that there's a boogeyman called moral relativism, right? Neither of us is a moral relativist. It's just that we recognize that we can't force our experience on other people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the other thing is and this is one of the things I've learned, is that I'm fallible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a really big thing I've learned in over the last several years.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, I as a Mormon, I wanted to find infallibility, but I've come to accept that it just isn't there for me. Mm-hmm. And so I could just be wrong, and that's mm-hmm. fine. I mean, I'm doing the best I can, but I could be wrong. I could be morally mistaken. And so it could be the case that people with different information set and different views reach a better conclusion than I do. And that's fine too. I mean, I think that people need to make their own decisions. At the time, I think in the first interview, I said, you shouldn't let people make you stop being Mormon, and you shouldn't let people make you be a Mormon. Mm-hmm. And I still believe that. When we try to compel other people to follow our identity choices, that is categorically wrong.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm facing this now because I've done at least a couple interviews where I've talked about my story, and people have gotten a sense from my Facebook posts and other places that my story's kind of changed since a year or two ago. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of people calling me out to say, hey, John, we want an update on your story. And then, like, my wife is like over my dead body. You know, she's basically saying every time you tell your story, you know, it causes big problems. Mm-hmm. Plus, it's not about you. Yeah. Plus, you know, there's an argument, and this isn't necessarily Margie's, but the argument is just that, you know, let people have their own story. You don't need to be telling your story. And, and you know, you could influence people. And instead of just always being in the mix, just get out of the mix and let people have their lives, because you could influence people. And why even put yourself in that position? So that's my final part of the question, and maybe you've already answered it, so feel free to just answer it very briefly if you want.
Yeah.
It's just, well, what if people now leave the church because of you? And is there any part of you that just feels that burden and says, man, maybe I shouldn't tell my story? Or another way to say that is, what would make you comfortable telling your story now when you might just kind of leave well enough alone? Because in reality, people should make their own decisions, and they don't need your data interfering with their decision.
My data doesn't interfere with their decision. This is not a true story. My data, what I am, is me, and I want to find a way of being me with integrity. One of the things that I have had a hard time with, you know, as a doubting Mormon, as a basically disbelieving Mormon, and then as a very quiet, inactive Mormon, is finding ways to say who I am and just be open and frank and loving about that. And I want to do that. And I want to talk about who I am, because I can't be who I am without talking about it. I'm a loudmouth. But telling people who I am and what I think, if that influences them, it's because they buy what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
I can't make people change their mind. Neither can you. We can't do that. What we can do is we can offer people ideas and points of view and stories. And those stories may be entertaining or not, and that's something. And they may have some kind of value. And if they do, that's because people chose to let them.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, here's, I remember having a conversation with you about this, Jay, and I was worried about what to tell people who were believers, who were happy being believers, if they asked me, you know, if I ran into them on the street and they were like, so what happened? Don't you believe anymore? Why don't you believe? And this has happened once or twice. And people who seem to be really happy, it's like, this might make them unhappy. So maybe I don't want to talk with them about this. Maybe I don't want to be honest. And what you said, in effect, was, you know, they're grown-ups. Is it respectful of you to feel like they need to have fewer points of view available to them and fewer, you know, fewer, less information that you may, than you may have? Mm-hmm. I mean, their happiness is something that you can determine. Their happiness is something that you have a right to assign to them. You know, I mean, that's the thing. I don't think anybody who isn't motivated to listen to this interview, you know, and isn't motivated to take what we're saying seriously is going to.
Oh, there are going to be people who listen to this just because it's so outrageous or something.
Yeah, but they won't be motivated to think hard about what we're saying because, you know, I mean.
Or to feel empathy.
Or to feel empathy, yeah. And here's the thing about that. That means that if somebody does feel empathy or is affected by it, maybe they're, you know, maybe they're looking for a way out, frankly.
Or if they're not, you know, if encountering us and engaging with us can help people find a broader and warmer Mormonism towards people who don't fit, that's a good thing, because that's the problem.
Maybe they're taking us seriously because they feel like they need to try to understand somebody in their family who's left.
When they don't take us seriously, they're doing the thing that Mormons do to outsiders. They're doing the thing that Mormons have done to feminists and gay and lesbian and queer people. They're saying, you're not in the group. You're bad. We don't want to hear your story. We're now the experts in your life.
Yeah. That's
the thing. If you want to not do that, a good way to start is by listening not just to us, but to all the people who you think are wrong.
Yeah. I guess that's a point of view. I just don't want to be like, I get to decide what other people are grown up enough to hear.
Yeah.
You know?
So why are you telling your story? Jason, why are you, and Taryn, why are you?
Because I really want to be, I want to reintegrate my identity. I want to be the person that I am, and I want to be clear, and I want to be open, and I want to be frank, and I want to let all my Mormon friends know I love them and I miss you guys. And I want to find a way of being in this community and with these people who are so much a part of who I've been and who I am without having to not be open. And so I have to do this to get there.
Taryn, how about you?
Well, two reasons. First, because you asked me to. I mean, seriously, that's my major motivation, is that you thought it would be interesting, and I like you, and I think you're doing worthwhile stuff. So, you know, and there's a secondary purpose, which is that it's really easy for, I haven't tried to explain this to many people. But if I do, it's really easy for them to hear, well, I was crazy and then I took medication and now I'm not, so I'm not Mormon anymore, which is not the story. Really not the story. You know, it's all about evidence and what I think is good evidence to make decisions on, and, you know, on the basis of, and what other people think is good evidence to make decisions on the basis of, and how our individual perspectives can affect that. And the thing about it is that I'm trying really hard to figure out how to answer questions that people ask me to their satisfaction, like, you know, giving them the information they're trying to get, without making them think that I'm saying, well, I think y'all are crazy and you need medication. Because I really don't think that. But, you know, I mean, you can imagine how easy it is for someone to hear that. if they only listened to the first two sentences of my explanation.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and I'm trying to figure that out, and I'm not very good at understanding how other people hear things. So, you know, maybe if people listen to this interview and throw feedback, nasty or not nasty, all over the internet, then I can look at that and start to understand where I go wrong in explaining this.
Hmm.
So.
Excellent.
Y'all are my cognitive therapy.
All right. Wow. Okay. How's it been? And we'll just a couple quick ones and then we'll wrap up. How's it been with family? And Taryn, I know that at the end of the last interview, you were actually saying that your family was a little bit worried about your, you know, activity in the church. So I'm guessing they're not destroyed that you've taken this turn.
No,
overall.
If they care at all, they're happy. They
yeah.
don't care that much. They figured out that I wasn't going to be. I mean, I spent, six, seven years in the church as an active, you know, by some definition, believing member. And I didn't turn, you know, I didn't start trying to knock the glass of wine out of their hand at family parties or giving the missionary pamphlets or whatever they thought I was going to do. So I don't think they care one way or another.
Okay. And Jason, your family, I got the sense that there was some intense pressure and they're very
serious and committed Latter-day Saints. And I think it's been difficult for them that we're not doing that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had a talk this last summer with my dad, and he was very kind and loving about it all. And since then, nobody's talked about it at all. And
we've seen them. We went on vacation with them. And they were just really, you know, I mean, they were great about it.
Yeah.
You know?
And I completely empathize with how they're feeling about this. My dad said that he wants to think of this as we're just spending some time outside the church. And I think that's okay because, you know, maybe he's right. I mean, I would never say this will never happen. I am open to being proven wrong. I've been proven wrong before. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. And, you know, I love my parents for being supportive like that. That hasn't been easy for them. It wasn't easy for me, but we're in a pretty good place.
We were afraid to tell them. And
then
Jay and his dad were driving a moving truck or something. And apparently your dad just said, you know, we should talk about this. And it was like, wow, this is everything we could have dreamed of as far as that goes. So that was really nice.
So better than you feared.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh,
well, you know, my kids are really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. So the million-dollar question is, are you happier and healthier than before? And actually, there's some interesting psychology research that I'm not an expert in, but it basically says that sometimes, you know, having a perspective that's more grounded in reality doesn't always necessarily lead to happiness. And there's sort of this
have a more accurate perception of reality, right?
Yeah, like depressive realism versus a little bit of ignorant, you know, happiness or joy.
Yeah.
And so how's it been for you guys?
Can I go first?
Yeah, Taryn.
Well, okay, I think I said earlier that it felt when I was thinking about all of this like I was about to just wantonly throw myself off a very tall cliff, right? I was terrified. I mean, we built, without realizing it, we had begun to build a lot of our relationship on, you know, on the church, frankly. And even as, you know, as a semi-unbeliever, I built a lot of my self-image and my identity around it. And I was terrified. And then when I, you know, when I finally threw myself off the cliff, I said, okay, this is just, you know, this is the way things are. This is, you know, what I really think. I figured out it wasn't a cliff. It was barely even a little tiny step.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you expect, it's like that thing. Okay. This is kind of convoluted since the Indiana Jones thing in the, you know, in the Temple of the Grail or whatever it is a thing about faith. But you know how he jumps out onto the into empty space and finds that he's standing on a bridge?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot like that. It was like, oh, wow. This is not as hard as I thought it was going to be. Yeah, I'm not unhappy. I think I'm happier. I mean, I'm staying home with our kids now. You know, I actually dropped out of grad school to take care of our kids for a little while and figure, you know, myself out. And, you know, maybe it's because I was in like heavy therapy and working through a lot of emotional stuff, you know, when I walked away from the church, but, it was a really smooth transition. And if anything, I think I'm a lot happier than I was. I mean, I have more time. I know this is a cliche, but I have more time for my family, not being a member, you know, not being active. I'm still a member. I don't think I'll ever do the dramatic gesture thing again. Cause you know, no, you know, I have more time for my family. I have more energy for them. We're not, you know, every Sunday morning is not a 5 hour long, torture session for the entire family. Because I've never been able to sit still through 3 hours of church. My cognitively, you know, my neurocognitively similar child certainly couldn't at 2.5, 3 years old. And you never knew when she was going to start loudly demanding during a prayer to see God right now, this instant, you know. But also, I mean, it was stressful. I'm not typical, though, because being in a big room full of people was really stressful for me. It was it's a source of intense anxiety and stress every weekend. So, and I found that all of the energy that I used to spend thinking about religion and about, you know, which I spent a lot of intellectual energy on it long after I stopped, you know, having any emotional experience of it. All that energy and all of that thought, suddenly it's like freed up. It's like there's less, you know, I have more internal resources for other things. And that's been really good. And I don't think I'd have been able to stay home just as an identity thing. I could be a Mormon mother or I could be a stay-at-home mother, but I could not reconcile myself to being a stay-at-home Mormon mother. I don't know why. There's nothing wrong with being a stay-at-home Mormon mother, but for some reason, until I left the church, I couldn't seriously reevaluate my grad school experience and the experience my kids were having, you know, because of our own peculiar circumstances. Because the only way I could prove to myself that I was that I was the sort of person that I wanted to be was by having a really active, salient identity outside of both my family and Mormonism. But when I walked away from Mormonism, suddenly I found that I didn't need that as much. I mean, I didn't need that identity and I didn't need that occupation in the way that I had before. So it made things a lot easier for me. Leaving the church. I feel kind of bad about that. Like, you know, like interpersonally bad. Like, sorry, I really do love y'all. I do.
Right.
But
yeah.
Jason, how about you?
I think being outside has removed an awful lot of weight from me. I mean, there were these moral conflicts that I've spent the last long time talking about with you that just aren't as big a deal now, right? I just don't have to worry about what can I do to counterbalance my participation in an organization that's hurting these people and those people and the other people. And so there's a whole bunch of strain that's gone from me. Now, that doesn't mean things are, you know, easy. Being the parent of an autistic kid is not easy. I don't think I would say that was easy.
Oh, this has given me so much sympathy for my own parents.
Yeah,
I can't even tell you.
But I'm happy. I mean, it's really hard for me to make comparisons, because I in this conversation and the way we're setting things up, we've been focusing on the things that were hardest for me about being Mormon. And it's easier to draw a really positive comparison between life right now and the hardest things about life then. And it's a lot harder for me to sit back and count the pluses and minuses. But I feel good.
Can I just say, my experience of Jay's emotional state has been that he's been a lot happier. You know, especially the last few years seemed so hard for you, Jay.
Yeah.
And you're just like a new man, you know? So.
All right. Well, I guess, you know, I'll end with kind of your thoughts on the future. You can talk about where you think you're going, if you want to take a gander at where the church is going. Mm-hmm. And if you want to just end with now, you know, if you still have beliefs or values, you know, what are
we still have values?
I thought I would just give that one.
Yeah. John Larson always says that, you know, people say if they weren't Mormon, they'd be out doing all these rapes and murders. I think that's what you just said.
Of course. And of course you do have values, but if you want to share any of those.
Okay.
So Taryn, I'll have you go first, and then Jay, you can end.
So which of those things do you want me to address first?
Whichever ones you feel comfortable in, all or none.
Okay, so let's reenumerate. There was the, what are my beliefs and or moral standards now?
Well, yeah. Yep.
Where's the church going?
And where do you see you guys going? And with your kind of your, let's just call it a secular testimony. Okay. So if you want to tackle your future and or the church's future, do that first. Are you guys thinking of, you know, like Unitarian Universalistic, no church?
I was surprised by this. We thought it would be kind of – the reason we started going to UU was because our younger daughter – you know, we named both of our daughters after Greek goddesses, right? And our older daughter, at some point when our younger one was about 2.5 – explained that they were both named after goddesses, and that entailed an explanation of what a goddess was. But you know, this was a 4-year-old explaining it to a 2-year-old, and there was some miscommunication. And a few days later, I noticed that Athena, our younger one, was walking around the apartment holding her hands out like you know, like power hands, and glaring at things and then getting mad. And when I managed to figure out what was going on, it's hard to really do a lot of questioning of a child that age about what they're doing in that sense. Turned out she had misunderstood, and she thought she was a goddess. And she was getting really angry, and this is actually a true story. She was really angry that her magic wasn't working. So I corrected the whole misunderstanding, said, no, honey, we named you after goddesses from these really old stories from a long time ago. Nobody believes in these goddesses anymore, but you know, it's not like your grandparents' religion, and that was a strategic mistake. Because, you know, that related the religion of the people around her who are religious to make-believe and to ancient mythology and to so on and so forth. And she started to feel without our realizing it, that's what she took away from the conversation. And she began to make very derogatory comments about religion. You know, it was, and about religious people, which we don't do. We don't talk about this at all in front of them. I mean, and we never talk about it like that. We don't think less of people for believing, you know, in religious stuff. And so one day she asked a question about somebody we knew who was religious, and we, you know, in terms of religion, and we answered it, and she started making fun of them. I mean, they weren't there, luckily, but it was like, so we suddenly realized we had to give her some, you know, some interpersonal experience with people who had, you know, what she would think of as religious beliefs. So we tried UU, which turns out, not so much on the hardcore religious believers at UU, which we knew, but, you know, the point was, they had a kids program and they teach tolerance of other people's belief systems. And we thought she really needed something like that. Mm-hmm. And so we were like, oh, well, you know, it's probably going to be really boring, but you know, we really need to do something. Let's go put them in the Sunday school and we'll just grit our teeth and we can sit in the lobby. Cause you know, we just assumed it would be boring and dull and woo woo and, you know, and all this stuff. And it turns out that it was this incredible experience. I mean, this, these people, it's this congregation full of people who are not unified by any sort of religious belief or creed. If they follow the national demographics, like a third of them are Christians or, you know, some other Abrahamic or, you know, deity believing God, you know, monotheistic God kind of worshiping people. About a third of them are neo-pagans and about a third of them are agnostic or atheists, right? With no religious like stuff going on. So they have diverse beliefs, but the thing is, this community, it, you know, on a small scale and not economically, because yeah, come on, but it is in so many little ways the thing that we both wanted the church to be because of the Book of Mormon. I mean, they're really that whole, they don't just talk explicitly, and they do talk explicitly about you know, mourning with those who mourn. I mean, I even heard somebody use that phrase. But they not only talk about that, but they actually do it, you know, and they work so hard to be in community with each other. And that's what their worship services are about. And it was beautiful and amazing. And I don't know if we'll still be there in a few years, but I could see myself, you know, doing this for the rest of my life very happily and feeling like I was around people who were actually helping me to be better and who I could help. So that's, I think, where I see myself, frankly. I mean, I've tried other, as you know, I've tried a variety of other religions and, you know, and, you know, I just don't, I'm not a believer, so that wouldn't work anymore. But the same underlying problems, like, you know, logical problems that I had with Mormonism were always there. But I can go to this place and I can say, yeah, no, I just don't believe any of that. And they'll be like, okay, let's be seriously in community anyway, you know, and really, you know, be there for each other. And it's like, you know, so I could see myself doing this for the rest of my life happily. As far as where the church is going, mm-hmm. that was my testimony of UU. I'm sorry about that, Unitarians. I know you don't like it when people do that. They're not supposed to proselytize, but anyway, and then where the church is going, I don't know. I mean, it's a hardcore, serious belief system, you know, that's kind of comprehensive. And so a lot of people who are Mormon will always be Mormon and probably always be happy in it. I don't see the church, even now, it's not growing with the population. Mm-mm. I mean, the church's growth rate is less than the population's overall growth rate pretty much everywhere. So I see it becoming a smaller and smaller proportion of the population, even as the church keeps growing. But I think it's going to become more and more marginalized, frankly, because, well, one thing I realized after I left the church is all those problems I saw with it, people outside see with it. So, you know, everybody seems to like Mormons in particular, but, you know, I don't see there being any kind of widespread conversion to Mormonism in the U.S., for instance, or pretty much anywhere else in the world. The few places where there aren't, where the church hasn't really established itself as a missionary group have already been pretty much comprehensively colonized by evangelical churches. And those churches are, you know, unlike the pre-existing religions in those regions to the extent that I don't really see people who are looking for a new social identity going for Mormonism. So I don't really see the church growing a whole lot. I think it's going to become politically more marginal. I mean, for a lot of reasons, there's a growing, even in like evangelical, you know, literalist Christianity, there's a growing progressivist movement that is dividing that community politically. So there's going to be even as people who are who have for a while been allies of the Mormon Church politically need the church more, they're going to have less power. So the church will have less power as well. I'm talking about evangelical churches that the church has allied with. I don't know. I don't think it's going to like fail or anything. You know, it's a nice home for a lot of people, even with all the problems. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people never have to confront the problems, you know? So, as far as my own beliefs, well, I mean, I wouldn't say that there's no chance that there's a God. I mean, because how would I know? I mean, how would I know? But I wouldn't call myself an agnostic either. I guess I think of myself as an atheist, but, I know that people think a lot of strange things about people who identify that way, not least because, you know, you could just call yourself an agnostic and then, you know, and then people wouldn't give you such a hard time. So why are you identifying that way? But, as far as my, you know, my beliefs go, I guess I, you know, the really definitive source inspiration for my beliefs about morality and for what we're doing, which I guess is kind of, you know, I'm a humanist. I don't like to call myself a secular humanist because I don't see much difference between secular humanists and religious humanists other than the belief in God thing, which isn't necessarily as significant as they think. But inspiration for what I think is right is actually Terry Pratchett books, which sounds awful, but there's this book that I first read before I went back to the church, actually, called, is it Small Gods? It's Small Gods. And it's about the reformation of this fictional, religious community in this fantasy world that, you know, that the Terry Pratchett books are about. And the person who ends up being the reforming prophet of this group is, I guess he's really a humanist. And what he comes to think after having been raised as a believer in literalist scripture interpretations and, you know, burning people at the stake and everything else, what he comes to believe is that all you can actually do is try to make things better for the people that you are with, you know, in the moment. It's always, always, you know, now the present is always with us, right? It's always where we are. And all we can do is try to make things better here and now for the people around us. And I guess that's what I think I need to be doing. You know, I mean, I may not think that Christ was God, but I still think he had some great ideas. You know, I mean, and I still cry every time I hear a poor wayfaring man of grief, not because, you know, of some abstract deity, but because turns out the reason I cried whenever I heard that song all along was because of the beauty of, you know, the thing that I think neurotypical people don't understand is that the real beauty of being human is in being able to be in community with other humans and to take care of them and to feel what they feel and to know that they feel what you feel. And that's, so what I think is important is taking care of the people around you. You know, trying to make the world better because no one else is going to do it. Mm. Except the other people who are, but you know.
But we all need each other's help in that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, beautiful.
So I wanted
long-winded.
No, not at all. Thank you, Taryn. That's good stuff. That's my favorite part of Mormon Stories. So thank you.
So I want to be a little bit bold and take your question of where the church is going. And here's what I'm going to say. By the time we're 80, the church is going to have ordained women to the priesthood. It's going to be sealing gay and lesbian couples in the temple.
Whoa.
And whatever the civil rights movement of the time, it's going to be fighting on the wrong side of that. Because that's Mormon history over and over. We're always 20 years behind. And that's where we're going to be in another 40 years. We'll be 20 years behind. But so that's my prediction. And if I'm wrong, then you'll know that I wasn't a true prophet.
Okay.
All right. But what do I believe? You know, I believe the things Taryn just said. I believe that the sun's going to come up tomorrow. And when it does, my kids are going to wake up and they're going to need hugs. And I'm going to give them hugs and it's going to be wonderful. I believe that I'm going to come into work and there are going to be a bunch of people who need me and I'm going to need them. And that's going to be wonderful too. And I believe that that is what we have and that is who we are. And if you lose sight of the wonder of every minute in your life, then there's nothing that can replace that. Because that is what there is, right? You know, whatever your metaphysics, life is the texture of its moments. If life lasts forever or for 80 years, it still is just right now and right now and right now. And it's the people and the places and the animals and the plants and the life around us and in us. And that's what I believe in. I believe in making life better. And that's my goal.
Make life better.
Make life better. You know? It's
small. Because it kind of sucks in a lot of ways.
It's possible. So. Yeah, and we can't fix everything. I can't stop the whatever's happening in Ukraine. I can't. But I can help my students think more critically about it. And some of my students are going to go on to be important people. And maybe something I do helps.
And you're probably going to have one student wander in because they're Ukrainian and you're the only political scientist they know and they need to cry about what's happening, right?
That happens. I've had that with the Syria thing that's happened a lot. And mm-hmm. I can't change. I can't help the people. I can't help my students' families who've died in Syria.
But you can help. You can be there.
And I can make that loss less bad. And that's the beauty of life.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Well, beautiful. Well, thank you, Jason, and thank you, Taryn. You guys stayed up till 12:30 your time.
Oh, my heavens, we did. Uh-oh.
Yeah, that thing I said about the sun's going to come up, it is going to come up.
Yeah. All right. Well, to both of you, thank you so much for returning to Mormon Stories in 9 years. I expect another interview about how you've returned. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Yeah.
All right. So that puts us around 2023. Just remember that.
Well, you know, John, if we come and go every 9 years, how many times will you have come and gone in between?
Ouch. Ouch. You'll have to ask one of my multiple personalities that question.
I think it's just we're sine waves and you just have a higher periodicity than we do.
Well, you both understand that there's virtue in never, ever changing your mind about anything, ever. That's a good thing.
All right. Well, anyway, thank you so much for coming on. And Jason and Taryn, if you feel so inclined, I definitely look forward to kind of the dialogue with Brad. I think that'll be epic.
Yeah, I'm greatly looking forward to that as well. Thanks, John.
All right, you guys.
Listen to that one.
All right. Well, bless you both and wish you well. And thanks for coming back on. Take care.
All right.
It's fun. Bye-bye.
And listeners, please go up to MormonStories.org. Give Taryn her feedback that she so desperately needs.
And, probably being less autistic.
And I'm sure Jay and Taryn will do their best to try and respond to respectful comments there.
Oh, come on. Even irrespectful ones. I don't care. Be as cruel as you want.
Is irrespectful a word?
No. I'm
great. 12:30.
All right. All right, you guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fee.